Okay. So it's a pleasure to be here. I talked to David Morrison about these results during the summer, and he didn't think they were crazy. And so he suggested I come here and tell you about them. So I'm a card-carrying solid-stater, and I guess there's sort of two of us who have taken up some of these string ideas. You all know who the other one is. And so I'm going to tell you about anomalous dimensions and ways of thinking about, or rethinking, rather, the ADS dictionary so that these ideas don't seem so strange. So this work was done with a couple of my collaborators, my student, and a math professor at Illinois, Gabriele Lanave. Okay, so let me just, since this is largely a high-energy audience, let me just put this problem in context. If you are looking at standard metals, there are a few things that you need to know. They all obey the Wiedemann-Franz law. And the second most important thing is that that number and that number are the same. Okay? It's impossible within the standard theory of metals for these numbers to differ. Okay. Now, the strange metal is one in which those numbers are not the same. Okay, so, and for example, the resistivity is a linear function of temperature. And if there is any scaling, it's occurring with an exponent which is not t to the minus, omega to the minus 1. It's some other power, and you all know Gary Horowitz has done early work on that. And the other thing is there's a violation of the Wiedemann-Franz law. So this ratio should be a constant. It's not. It seems to increase as a linear function of temperature. And it's this conglomeration of results that we call the strange metal. Now, this problem of the strange metal comes about.
So sorry, this violation of Wiedemann-Franz law, any violation makes it a strange metal? Or a strange
No. I'm just saying
a violation?
These three things make it the strange metal.
Okay, but are you going to tell me that strange metals have that ratio do something else and not just be...
No, strange metals have it do this. So when I say strange metal, I mean this.
Then you're not constant.
Yeah, it should be pi squared over 3.
Yeah.
And that's really based on a quasi-particle picture.
Okay.
So we have no way of understanding this behavior within a quasi-particle picture, which really is what underlies the standard theory of metals. So something else is being transported. And that's what I want to get at. Okay, so what I'm going to propose is that what is strange about the strange metal is something very strange. That the not only does the current not have the dimensions that we normally think it has to have, but also the gauge field doesn't have a dimension of 1. Okay, now I know David Gross is turning over this right now, is squirming because he wrote a paper saying this cannot be true. I will get to that result. And this requires non-local actions. At least that's where I think it leads to. I have no way of understanding this if you don't have non-local actions. Okay. So, and I propose that one can detect this. It's a fraction. It's a fraction.
By J, you mean?
Absolutely.
The conserved curry.
The conserved curry. I know. You wrote a paper. I'm going to show the result, which tells us how to think about this, and then the loophole that you may have probably thought about but didn't consider seriously. Okay. So, with those words, I want to show that one can actually detect. If anything I tell you is correct, I propose that there is an experiment which, if it comes out looking this way, then everything I've told you is correct. If it doesn't come out looking this way, then everything I've told you, you should just ignore. But they haven't done the experiment yet. Okay?
But they will.
Oh, there are many people trying to do it right now. I mean, it is the experiment right now to do on the strange metal. Okay? Okay, so let's get started. Okay, why is this problem interesting? So if you look at this ratio of theories of the cuprates over theories of the strange metal, this ratio is basically infinite. And it's infinite because we have no theories of the strange metal. Okay.
What's your benefit for that?
you'll see. Okay. Okay. So, now, why is this problem hard? Okay, this problem is hard because of something I pointed out roughly 14 years ago. That if one attempts to do the simplest thing that you can do to understand power laws. So if you assume that underneath these power laws is some sort of critical phenomena, then you just go and do scaling. And let's say you go and do scaling with a single parameter. If you go and do scaling with a single parameter, so the time is also scaling with this length scale which is diverging with an exponent z, you end up with these exponents right here. And the problem is, once again, this number has to be 1 in the strange metal. This number has to be minus 2/3. Notice these things are negatives of one another, as I pointed out to you already. There's no way of getting this. Okay? Even if you introduce an anomalous dimension, it will enter in both things in the same way. So you can't get it. So single parameter scaling, which is what everyone had sort of had in their heads when they made this, when one would make the statement that quantum criticality underlies T-linear resistivity, there is no way of understanding that within the standard scenario. Okay, so we need something else. Some sort of new length scale in the problem, so some sort of new physics. Okay, now let's get to David's argument. Okay, what are the dimensions of the currents? So we know if there's a conserved current, we look at the generators of U1, the zero component of the current has this particular commutator, and since this has the same units as this, the units of the current are set by this delta function, and hence it has to have units of L to the minus D. Okay, and it's not going to change under renormalization. Okay, so that's, it has dimension D. Okay, and if you look at the conservation law, the local conservation law, so Ward identities are applicable here, this is proportional to that, and hence J mu, the other components have to have unit, have to have dimension D. Okay, now you can, however, change the dimensions of the current. Just let me look at a non-relativistic case. So if, for example, time is scaling as some power to the z, then you can change the dimensions of the current. And this will enter as z minus 1. Okay, so z is 1, you end up, this thing cancels off. And you can also introduce a hyperscaling violation exponent. And this hyperscaling violation exponent says that perhaps along some dimension, things aren't flowing. And so you can easily introduce all of this. And there is a consistent way of thinking about this kind of physics. You can write down dilaton actions, in which you have a dilaton field coupled to your gauge field. So you can effectively change the dimension of the current through this function. And you can also introduce an anomalous dimension for the gauge field with this sort of behavior. Now, one thing I want to point out is that the standard holographic construction has AT scaling as mu. Times dt. Okay, so it's the time component of the gauge field. Okay, so it's sourcing a chemical potential at the boundary. This does not do that. So the kinds of actions people write down that introduce these anomalous dimensions for the current, the gauge field is not really acting as a source for a chemical potential at the boundary, since this does not go to a constant. Okay, now note, you might say, what are we talking about a current when you have a mass for the gauge field? Okay, that's a realistic question. The only solutions of these kinds of geometries, at least when you back react this to produce a Lipschitz type geometry, the only solutions which give you non-zero zeta and theta, in fact, correspond to a massive field. And this is a massive bulk field. And it seems as if then what you have is a superconductor. Okay?
Excuse me. I mean, these are bulk actions you're talking
about.
Yeah. So the current there is a bulk current.
It's bulk current, but it's... Right, but it's... But the chemical potential which would be introduced is not the standard one, okay, because this is having this particular scaling. So what I'm saying is underneath this construction is not the standard one where there's a source current at the boundary.
But there's always two solutions.
There are two solutions, but in this case, that one of them does not look like that.
What is A is nothing. What is that?
Yeah, it's just the time component of the gauge field.
So what must be happening is that J mu, J mu is not zero, right?
Yes, that's right.
But that's okay then.
This is fine. I mean, but what I'm saying is that you can play this game. You aren't changing the, in this you are changing the dimension of A.
So you're also breaking the gauge, right?
Well, yeah, because you've introduced a mass for the gauge field.
The current is not conserved.
The current is not conserved. Okay, so I just want you to remember this, that this sort of action can be introduced, which does introduce a new dimension for the gauge field.
But it's not a gauge field.
Well,
it's a vector field.
Well, okay, for...
And I just want to get my conceptual framework here straight. Is it a gauge field or is it not a gauge
field? No, it's not. No. There's no gauge invariance. So A can always twist scalar.
Okay, so... Yeah, but the transformation that you would do is still A mu goes to A mu plus derivative with respect to lambda.
You can do that.
Yeah.
It's not a symmetry of this action.
So I'm just trying to give you the history of how you can think about these Lipschitz types of geometries, but they don't solve the problem that I'm particularly interested in. Okay. Now, one of the things that comes about in this context is the fact that you have to worry about what the boundary terms are. Now, the boundary terms you can get by just solving the equations of motion. The boundary action will look like this. And the question is, are these terms finite? So you just go and write these terms down, and what you find is that they're typically infinite. Okay? So in terms of a sort of a holographic construction in which the boundary terms are finite in these Lipschitz geometries, it's sort of an unknown whether or not you can really construct one which has a non-zero zeta. Okay.
You're starting from a bulk map theory of massive vector bosons?
In this particular case, yes, that's right.
And you're trying to ask whether there's a reasonable boundary theory that's built to it?
Right.
Why should you?
Well, so I'm just saying that you have to add the boundary term so that the action is sort of on shell is consistent. And so far, we've not been able to construct that within these scenarios.
But in general,
Yeah, but you still have to add the counter term so you can actually go and calculate things like the currents at the boundary, and that has not been done within such theories.
Is there a claim that it can't be done, or just that someone hasn't worked hard enough to do it? Because I'm surprised that...
That the claim is so far no one has been able to do it.
Okay, but there's not a claim that there's a no-go
through. No, those are very dangerous sorts of statements. Okay.
But does the surface term itself have to be finite? It regulates the action, right?
I mean, it certainly regulates the action.
Plus
but
the surface term, which should be
finite. Right. So what I'm saying is that plus those terms, no one's been able to construct.
Something which keeps the action finite.
Which keeps the action finite. Okay, that's the problem. And the best work has been done by this guy, Tario, that I mentioned, and he was not able to do it as well. Okay. Okay, now all of this that is just sort of changing. Let me just look at a more basic sort of thing. The reason why the gauge field sort of has to remain invariant is that this function is dimensionless and hence A just has dimensions of momentum. Okay, so within the Lipschitz types of geometries, you can change the scaling of J, but A remains fixed.
But that would be true in any dimension.
This is true in any dimension.
But the Gates field?
Yeah, this is true in any dimension.
So
absolutely.
The field has dimension two in any dimension.
Absolutely. This is true. Okay? As long as this statement is true, this has to be true.
This isn't the part that I...
Yeah. This isn't... Yeah, okay.
No, I didn't have this part before.
Yeah, this is a gauge transformation of the theory, okay?
And A is gauge variance.
Yeah. This is a statement of gauge invariance, okay?
No, but it doesn't mean the notion of dimension of A is gauge dependent, given that A is gauge dependent. What do you mean by dimension? You have those brackets. Why don't you tell us what you mean?
Well, it's just its dimension is
what
just.
Does that mean?
Well, dimension is determined by just the momentum.
But what does it mean? Define the dimension.
Define the dimension. So if you are making the statement that at a critical point, A has is sensitive to fluctuations which are of a certain, that has a certain energy spectrum, how is A coupling to those? Okay? Now, we know under renormalization, this can't change, okay? Okay. So, we do know, however, that J and A are coupled because you compute the current in this way. Okay, so how is it that you can come up with a theory in which the reason why the current acquires an anomalous dimension is that the underlying gauge field also has an anomalous dimension? So that's the question I want to ask. Okay, and this is not possible within these Lipschitz types of geometries. Okay, so what if your continuity equation looked like this?
Again, I really don't know what you mean by dimension. It certainly is not true of the dimension at UV fixed points. The dimension of that
No, but it's fixed by this gauge transformation.
That's a gauge dependent thing.
But if your theory is.
Say a QED.
Yeah, I know you're going to come up with QED. Okay. Right. Okay, so.
Gauge theory in the UV, it's dimension dependent. Behaves like a scalar field. A propagator, sorry, the two-point function, which scales x, one over x to root twice the dimension.
Yeah, but
Coulomb's law depends on the dimension. It's one over r squared. And four dimensions, as we know, one over r in three dimensions, logarithmic in two dimensions.
Right, but so
Coulomb's law is the two-point function of the nature.
Right, but so the question then is, can it change as a result of approaching an IR fixed point? Okay. And
just this argument of the gauge invariant is obviously a gauge artifact. It doesn't tell you anything about the physical dimension. It doesn't affect Coulomb's law.
Yeah, but through renormalization, you cannot change that dimension. Okay, I mean that's sort of fixed. So
there are indeed corrections to that, both in the UV and the UV fixed point and the infrared fixed point. Sure. But it certainly isn't one.
Well, you could argue that plus one. You could argue that QED is not really a fixed point because the gauge coupling constant depends on the
scale. Well, we know that QED is actually infrared scale. So
yeah, but the gauge coupling constant is zero.
What is it, zero? So, the logarithmic correction. But it's up to logarithmic correction. I just don't understand your definition of dimension. The dimension of the cart, which integrated over,
right.
Usual argument after when you record it is, that the charge is a number.
Right, the charge is a number.
If you have a theory with a global symmetry, not
right.
Local symmetry, global symmetry, you have a conserved charge, that's a number. and numbers on number of electrons.
Right.
That's the integral over space of the current. So the current has that one. Current density, J naught, as that we mentioned.
So in the constructions that I am going to look at, J does not have those dimensions.
But for example,
okay, and the particular, and what I'm trying to understand is how, and it's not just that statement.
Rock quantization tells you that the flux of a magnetic field in two dimensions through a sphere is equal to the magnetic charge, which is quantized in units of 1 over E, and that'll tell you that F, right, has dimension F, has dimension 1.
Right.
A physical definition is going to give you the kilometer. It's not going to give you 1, as you say, for A.
Okay, can you just, okay, so F, if you want to translate what I'm saying about A to F, fine, okay?
Well, you're saying that F has to have dimension 2. A is dimension 1, F has dimension 2.
Okay.
That's wrong. If you work out Dirac quantization, say, in, it's correct in 4 dimensions, but it's wrong in 2 dimensions, for example, or in 3 dimensions. The electric charge has dimensions.
Okay, so David, I'm really interested in the case in which I can have a fractional number here.
Of A, but I'm just telling you.
Or even, for A or F, which would require a different gauge transformation than the kind I have just outlined.
But I'm just saying the argument is incorrect. That the dimension of A is determined by the fact that under gauge transformation it transforms like a total derivative of something. That's just a gauge transformation. It doesn't affect the physics. So this thing you're adding that doesn't affect the physics has dimension 1. Who cares? The physics, like the number of monopoles, which is a number, work out the Dirac quantization, the dimensions of the electric charge, Stokes theorem will determine the dimension in one dimension, the dimension of F, which is the derivative of A, is 1, as you would expect.
Okay, so I am going to actually look at the consequences of Stokes' theorem, and it's actually going to change if you do change this underlying gauge transformation.
When you do the Stokes' theorem argument, you count the number of monopoles, you're integrating F, the flux.
You were introducing
this, and that's physical. That's a number, and,
right,
and it doesn't change when you make a gauge transformation. The argument that gives you the so-called dimension of A, gauge transformation doesn't change the physics.
Okay.
There might be a piece of A which doesn't change the physics that has dimension 1. But it's nothing to do with a piece of A that gives the gauge invariant observable physics.
Okay, I think del cross A equaling B is what you are looking at to get the quantization. And that's going to change under this transformation. To get Stokes' theorem, that's what you need, okay?
And that doesn't change under gauge. That's gauge invariant.
No, I will. Okay, so.
You're saying the magnetic field is gauge dependent.
Yes. If you argue that B has an anomalous dimension, yes, that's the whole construction.
But that is a sort of obviously incorrect argument.
Well, I'm saying
take two dimensions where the integral of B through the sphere. Mm-hmm. Is the number of monopoles in the sphere, and the monopole charge of a Dirac is 1 over E.
Right.
And E has dimensions of mass. B.
Aren't there different conventions for whether you absorb a charge into A or not?
Right. Number.
No, but he's saying that number. The number is.
So,
number.
No, I, I know, but you're talking about the dimension of A. You can define A with the factor of the charge, with the fundamental charge in it or not.
But
right?
The argument he started, which is not, you know, you really shouldn't be allowed to proceed, is based on that the dimension of A is 1, because I'm allowed to make a transformation on A, which changes by something which is a derivative of a function. There's no dimension. And that's 1. But you're not changing the physics. So from that, you cannot conclude anything. You can say the dimension is anything you want. It won't change the physics, because the physics, by definition, doesn't depend on the H transformation. It is a very meaningless argument.
OK, you are saying that the, OK. If you're trying to write down an action that, in fact, A, in which A has a anomalous dimension, as does J.
The notion of a dimension, as you know, only applies to a situation where you have scale invariance. Writing on the action around some, I'm not sure what you mean by previous sentence. Writing down an action doesn't tell you anything about anything. It just tells you something about the engineering dimension, which might change. The engineering dimension of A is obviously D minus 2 over 2. Because the action has no dimension, and space-time has dimension D. And you pick up two derivatives, and then you have two fields, and you divide by 2. So that's the engineering dimension of A.
Well, okay, so I want to write down a class of actions in which that is not the case. But they're still invariant. But they're still gauge invariant.
Well, if you're doing a gauge theory, they better be gauge invariant.
Okay, so the whole point is that it has been... Okay.
I
was gonna, okay.
But can you define your symbol first? You wanted to write down this conservation equation. I don't know what grad upper alpha dot j mu means.
So it's the... It's the fractional it's the fractional gradient of J.
Oh, that's right. What is the fractional gradient of a?
I'll get to this.
Okay.
Okay, I'll get to this.
One dimension we understand by Fourier transform, let's say.
Let me just. Okay, so at any number of dimensions, you can write down the fractional derivative of any function of x. As okay.
Why not just take the first and then turn it in?
Okay, so this is the Riemann-Liouville convention for the fractional derivative. Are there any number of ways in which one can construct the fractional derivative? This is one particular way. The Rietz calculus is different, in which it is based on the Fourier transforms, but this is the one that I'm going to
use.
What
is the QB for the Fourier transform?
We can go work that out. It would be IK. So it depends on whether or not you get mod k to the alpha or k, I k to the alpha, because there's a phase degree of freedom in this.
But this is d alpha, a function of 1x.
Yeah, you can generalize this to any dimension you want, okay? Okay?
Well, but you have just, what would it be for
okay.
five dimensions?
For example, if you wanted to take the grad, so this is now the Laplacian. So it's the fractional Laplacian of a function. This is equal to that's what.
But you don't mean the Laplacian del squared?
To the alpha.
clear, you don't have del squared, you have du.
Right. So each of these derivatives is just this thing right here. Okay? Each of those derivatives is just one of those integrals that you have to go and do.
Then don't you lose rotational invariance?
Which is, but your theory is based on the Laplacian, which is why I wrote down this quantity. Okay?
No, but this theory has...
No, this is just a non-local conservation law.
Is it rotationally invariant?
Yes, it is. Well, this statement I made here is certainly not, but the ultimate theory is, okay? So...
You'll explain that later.
I will explain this later. I will explain this. Okay. Okay. So the gauge transformation that is consistent with this continuity equation is the one where you have partial mu to the alpha. It's a fractional derivative. Okay. Now, and so both of these will have anomalous dimensions. Okay, now what kind of function is this derivative with respect to of mu to the alpha? Okay, so if, let me just sort of set this up. If V is just an open set, and if F is equal to zero, X element of V, and this operator is acting on this gives you zero, and if this is only true for F equals zero, then T is anti-local.
So what is T?
So T is an operator acting on F that also gives you zero for X an element of the set. And if the only way in which both of these statements is true is if F is equal to zero, then T is an anti-local operator. Okay, let me give you an example of this. Okay, let's look at why this quantity is anti-local. If you just look at the derivative, respect to Y, of just a polynomial, it's equal to this function. This is one way of constructing it, by repeated integration. Okay, so you're replacing factorials with gamma functions. Okay? Now, if you just look at the fractional derivative, the alpha fractional derivative of a constant, it's not equal to zero. It's equal to this function right here. Okay? Now, if you look at the case in which alpha is equal to any integer, because of the poles of the gamma function, this thing is in fact equal to zero. Okay? So what you have is a situation in which the function is certainly constant, but the derivatives are non-zero. So this is giving you something that is spreading as a function of space. Yeah, that's what I mean by anti-locality. Okay. So an anti-local operator is something which takes a function that has a certain support and spreads it out over a bigger space. An infinite space. And what I want to show is that if you go and think about what the ADS dictionary is really all about, it's really about anti-local operators. And these operators affect how we might think about entanglement. Yeah, that's really the point of today's talk. And these play a role in trying to understand how it might be that J and A both have anomalous dimensions. Okay, now why should A have an anomalous dimension? Okay, Hartnell and Karsh wrote down a series of scaling relationships for the gauge field, the magnetic field, the heat current, and the electrical current, all of which involve an anomalous dimension.
Sorry, what theory?
There's no theory. This is just a statement.
In a gauge theory.
They didn't write, they don't, maybe I didn't make it clear.
What is A and B?
Well, the A, this is the magnetic field. This is what the charge, whatever is carrying the current, this is what it's coupling to in some sort of gauge theory. They never constructed a theory.
But didn't they derive this from some bulk action?
No. No, they did not. They did not, which is why we have had any number of exchanges over this.
The definition of the framework for working in is where A and B are abelian vector fields.
Yeah.
And physical observables are invariant under gauge transformations.
Some gauge transformation. They never specify what it is. It's not the one that, it's not A going to A plus derivative respect to lambda, because that way this will never be true. Okay? They did not write down a theory. They said, if we assume that all of this is true, with phi equal minus 2/3, so that then there's no hyperscaling violation, one can explain all of these properties of the strange metal.
Independent of the dimension of space-time?
For D equals 2.
D equals.
The spatial number of dimensions is 2. Okay, because that will, of course, that always changes what the ultimate dimensions are, but that will give you phi equals minus 2/3. For two spatial dimensions, what you're interested in, phi is equal to minus 2/3. So it's a very large anomalous dimension.
Well, especially since I would say that the dimension of A is 1/2.
Okay, fine. So the statement then requires a lot of explanation. How do you get phi equals minus 2/3? Okay, they never explained that, okay? And that is what I've been trying to understand. How could phi be minus 2/3?
Whatever the dimension of A means.
Okay. So what I want to ask right now is, what else could you explain if you assume that A has an anomalous dimension, whatever A is? Okay?
Sort of grimace every time you say it is an abelian theory, right?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So is it correct from your point of view, whenever you say the dimension of A is something, for me to say that if I add one to that, that's the dimension of the magnetic field? Is that correct?
Yes, because I'm taking a derivative, yes.
So you're saying the canonical dimension of the magnetic field is 2.
I take that back. No, it's not correct to say that. It's not correct to say that. Because the underlying gauge transformation that relates A now to B is not the same one that you know.
So can
okay?
you rephrase this in terms of the dimension of something physical that I can measure?
That is what I'm going to get to at the end. There is a physical thing that does change, A dot dl, okay? But it's not pi r squared, right? The Aronov-Bohm flux is going to change fundamentally, okay?
So in your theory, therefore, which is not just the integral of A dx.
Yes.
Okay. Which yes. In your case, according to you, would always have dimensions zeros.
Yeah.
It is E A dx. There is an electric charge there.
It's more complicated.
The experimentalists actually measure the electric charge.
Yes, that's right.
In units,
yeah, right.
Except in D equals 3.
Right.
Which have JIT units.
Right. Yeah. That numbers. Look. Right.
So your phase E A dx. Is not a number.
Going back to original good old QED, isn't this discrepancy sorted out if you say that what you're giving the dimension of is E times A, and that has dimension 1?
You said A.
I know. Okay, but but it's true.
That
E times A.
Right? That always has dimension 1.
Okay, yeah, so does that...
That does sort out the issue. Yeah, that's really what I meant. Sorry, David.
Is that the thing that comes in the gauge transformation?
Yeah, that's the thing that comes in the gauge transformation. Okay? Okay. But look, I said that equal to 1 and... okay, fine. Look.
So it's dimension
okay.
of E times A.
Okay.
But not really.
Okay, so I want to go on now that we got that sorted out because there's a lot to do. Okay, so they did not in their paper consider the AC properties. They only wrote down their scaling analysis was applied to all of the DC properties of the strange metal. So what I want to do is ask the question, does the same assumption, like explain omega to the minus 2/3? Can you somehow tailor can that assumption be shown to explain this omega to the minus 2/3? Now what the experimentalists see is it fits a Drude conductivity. Okay, so let's just take this seriously, and the phase between the real and the imaginary parts is 60 degrees, consistent with this exponent being minus 2/3. Okay? So it's a fairly fundamental thing because both the real and the imaginary parts are exhibiting the same scaling. Okay, so what we did is the following with my student, Lim Trugul. We said, let's just take the experiment seriously and introduce a continuous mass or a generalized free field analysis of this conductivity. So the conductivity then will just be an integral over all of the things which now might depend on the mass. And the mass is going to be the variable which is changing continuously. Okay, so it's like a multi-band type theory. So I'm going to say now the density, the charge, and the scattering rate all depend on mass, and sigma is just, this is sigma of m and omega, and I'm integrating this over all possible mass. Okay, so for those of you who know, this is sort of like the continuous mass formalism of a scale invariant sector. Okay, and I introduce these distributions for what the density, the charge, and the relaxation time might be. And they all have different exponents. I'll say what those are in a few minutes, but let's just go and do this integral. So the integral looks like this, and this can all be pulled out, and the frequency dependence will look like this. And so I can go and perform the integral. I simply set this equal to this, because this will give me the correct behavior. This integral can be done, and you end up with the correct behavior. Okay. Now, so far, this is not a deep statement, because A, B, and C are completely, I have three variables to fit one parameter. Okay, but let me show you that there's something deep here. Okay? So the deep statement is that you don't need an anomalous dimension. Okay, let's look at what these things mean physically. This deviating from one is just the hyperscaling violation exponent. This is a running charge, so it's really saying that you have an anomalous dimension, and C is telling you about momentum relaxation in the system. Okay? So what you need to get this to be minus 1/3 is you can get C equal to 1 and A plus 2B equal to 2/3, which means B can be equal to 0. Okay, so if you just go and independently model the AC transport, you don't need an anomalous dimension. However,
in fact, you have discrete levels, but you're now looking, this is the behavior that matters here when your n equals 0.
No, there's a certain cutoff over which you have the scale invariant behavior, and that's where I've done the integral.
Well, what determines the scaling behavior that you're trying to reproduce is the behavior of the many states near 0 n?
No, it's over. I've just over the whole range.
There's
some range over which this is the scaling behavior. So, in other words, there's some cutoff frequency over which this behavior happens.
I'm just asking, what is the range that is really crucial here?
Okay, so it seems to. So this behavior is observed in 1 eV and like 50 MeV. M is small MeV, not your big MeV. Okay. Okay, so you don't need an anomalous dimension. However, if you combine our analysis with the analysis of Karch and Hartnall, phi in our theory is B times Z, B has to be non-zero, which means you need an anomalous dimension. Okay, and that will also give you this behavior for the T-linear resistivity. So the point of it is, with one assumption, namely that however you want to say E or E times A or A, if the gauge field has an anomalous dimension, you can explain everything about this strange metal.
But it's not the anomalous dimension. So it really has to do with the distribution of levels.
It's a
charge comes.
Yes.
The charge really is coming in integer multiples of the electric charge.
Yes.
And not actually.
Right. Yes. That's right.
So it has to do somehow with the distribution of levels.
Yes.
And it really has nothing to do with anomalous dimension. But A, it's an effective anomalous dimension, as Steve said, of E times A. But that comes from the multiplicity of...
Well, it's coming really because E...
which is EI...
Is scaling.
But EI is...
I'm allowing E to run.
Yeah, but you know that it isn't running. It's still multiples of the electric charge. It's, you're not getting the fraction. That's through the distribution of many states. That must be the reason you're...
Okay, so if you think about mass being energy, what I'm saying is that at any particular energy scale, what you mean by the charge carriers, the charge that they have, is a different value. Okay? So what you mean by the charge carriers is changing fundamentally.
Go back to the place that you started with a discrete, the definition of, you had a discrete sum. Let's go back there.
Right.
Actually,
so this is where I started it. I said, okay.
Well, that's true for each quasi particle. Or
I would say this is. State, yeah.
And all those EIs are integers. Okay. Integer multiples of order. Or are you saying they're quasi particles with any value?
They're with any value. It's a completely, it's a complete continuous spectrum here.
Of what?
Okay, for lack of a better word, these are unparticles, okay? This is just a complete scale invariant sector. Okay, that's what this is. It's a scale invariant sector.
Charge quantization, however, is more rigorous than that.
I'm aware of that, and I have not violated that.
Yes, you have, of course you have.
No, I haven't, because if I tilt...
I put in magnetic, I have... Let's say real magnetic monopoles in the world. Are those, you know, that's inconsistent with that. It's of course not. We're starting with the theory of QED. There could be monopoles. I could put one in. Those charges had better be one over the monopoles. But when you have a sum over those things, over lots of EIs, which might be 1, 2, 3, and MIs and NIs that vary, sometimes it makes sense, not because of necessarily because EI changes, because NI and MI change, you know, there are various values. And
but David, if you want to interpret
sum over many
yeah,
terms.
Right. Okay, if you want to interpret these as integers, you can. But I'm not wedded to that picture.
I want to interpret EA as, you know, as that E is an integer.
I want to see the ABS CFT part.
yeah, that's. Okay, so this is the setup for why I have been thinking about this, which probably has gone on longer than you wanted to. But anyway, it is what it is. Okay, so the bottom line is this anomalous dimension is something which... Okay. Okay, so we need some sort of new physics to end up with something that looks like this. Okay, so what theories have these anti-local interactions, this derivative respect to alpha? Okay, so let's look at hyperbolic spacetime. The statement is that the boundary, the way we understand quantum gravity, at least right now, is that there's some local CFT which has all the information about the about this hyperbolic spacetime with any sort of massive object in it, okay? And it's really a statement, since we have operators, but if it's a CFT, operators and states are the same, here we only have states, it's really a correspondence, it's a one-to-one between states. That's what I mean by the correspondence. So I'm talking about a state-to-state correspondence here. Okay, now we also know that any theory with gravity has less observables than a theory without it. So one thing that's always puzzled me is how can the boundary be a local CFT? Okay, so here we have an equality between quantum gravity and some boundary local QFT. And when you have an equal sign, you really are saying these two things are equal, but the things on either side look very different. Okay, so one might say that it's sort of, we don't really understand what the word is in this context because the two things we are equating are sort of different. Okay, so if we look at how at holography, at how it typically is organized, there are two ways in which we understand this correspondence.
Well, sorry, not again, I think you already said it. If you have a Hilbert space on one side, a Hilbert space on the other side, there's a one-to-one map, et cetera, then that's your equality.
Yeah, but that's an equality in the sort of Whiteman construction formalism.
Well, it's in the... It's giving them as, equivalent quantum theories, if it holds, and that's the question.
Right, okay. So I'm going to go through both of these constructions, okay? And
there are equalities. I think Steve is saying that aren't tautologies.
I never said these are tautologies. I said that the reason why this was sort of new is that it wasn't a tautology. And we,
but it is possible to believe it if they're not identical, the same thing.
Yes, but we are still grappling with how this can be true. Okay. So one of the standard things that one does is one interprets, at least the way holography was sort of rewritten, is that a field in the bulk is being sourced at the boundary. And here we understand this sort of semi-classically by a field which is scaling as some power to the delta, and the dimension of the corresponding operator is equal to delta. Okay, so one of the questions that arises in this is how do we assemble the bulk data, the boundary data from the bulk theory? And here several people, some of whom are in the audience, are responsible for how we think about this correspondence. And the P here is Joe, of course. Okay? So these sort of what's called the differentiate way of thinking of, or at least what's the differentiate way of thinking about this is to construct a boundary action which has the corresponding operator and the restriction of your bulk field to the boundary. And it's in that context that we understand the partition function then, which is averaged over all the standard metrics, which have a double pole singularity, and that gives us information. And this supergravity partition function is equivalent to then the partition function in the CFT. Okay, the other way of thinking about this is through the sort of Whiteman construction of the operators, in which you imbue, the states in the Hilbert space, some sort of, you simply construct this for any endpoint function, and what you mean by the operators then is this sort of equivalence. Okay. Now these are on the surface very different statements. Okay, and they were shown to be equivalent by Harlow and Stanford. Okay, so what I want to do is look a little deeper in each of these constructions and ask the question, can O be determined exactly in some cases? And what I want to show is that for the cases in which I can determine O, using the procedure, using the Whiteman construction, with the help of the sort of holographic renormalization that Joe and Heemskerk developed, and just using this Witten formalism, O always is an anti-local operator.
O is what?
The bulk field? No, O is the boundary operator that is dual to some bulk field.
I'm sorry, what does it mean to say O is anti-local? You gave a definition earlier about what it means to be an anti-local operator acting on a space of functions.
Right.
But O acts on CFT states. What?
But the states are functions. I mean.
Well, okay.
Okay, in a CFT they are.
Stop. When you say states are functions, what I think you mean is you use the Schrodinger picture representations, that they're functionals on field space.
Right.
So is that your statement, that
yeah.
A is anti-local
yeah.
on fields?
Yeah.
O is anti-local on field
yeah.
space.
Yeah.
Okay, right. So it's not making a statement of its locality in the CFT space-time. It's on,
right.
on this field space. Okay.
Okay. So what I want to do is...
Before you go any further, I haven't really thought about this. In general... Oh, I see. So you're saying it's not like a multiplication operator you might have in linear quantum field theory.
Yes, like a momentum operator. It's not like that.
But what about a position? I mean, I just in linear quantum field theory, phi in the Schrodinger representation, that's anti-local, right?
No, local. Right?
It's both, but it's anti-local in this sense. If there's a region of field space on which the function, on which the wave function is non-zero, and I multiply it by x, I don't get zero. Right? We're thinking Schrodinger's representation, linear field theory.
Okay, so...
So pi would be not anti-local, but conjugate to phi would not be anti-local.
No, but the support... There is no... The statement about anti-locality is that if the function is equal to zero, x times the function, sorry, any operator times a function, there is no support for the operator acting on the function giving you zero where the function wasn't already zero.
Right. But multiplication operators, which are non-zero on V, satisfy that property. I mean, like a Weyl operator, e to the ix in quantum mechanics. That's a non-local operator. That's an anti-local operator in this definition, right? E to the I lambda x, you multiply it by a function which is non-zero, you don't get zero. That's why I don't say that a Weyl operator. So e to the I lambda x. Those are anti-local in this definition. Is that correct?
Quantum mechanics. What was your field theory?
Well, so the field theory is, you know, e to the I lambda integral of phi of x over some region, equal Weyl operator. It's just like e to the I lambda x in quantum mechanics. So if you're telling me that those are anti-local, I think I believe you, but I'm not surprised because it's true in linear field theory. If I understand your definition of anti-locality.
I thought the definition of anti-local was that if you have something that's zero in a neighborhood and you act with the operator and it's still zero in the neighborhood, the only way that can happen is if the thing was zero everywhere. That's not true.
It's zero. It's already zero in the neighborhood.
Yeah. So start with a function that's like non-zero here. Now multiply it by e to the ix. It's still zero in the neighborhood, but the function is not zero everywhere.
It automatically becomes non-zero is the statement.
Yeah.
So if you had something that was really non-local, like had kind of
like a measure isolation,
e to the ix. Okay. Yeah. All right. Good. Okay. So linear field theory, this doesn't happen.
No.
But in interacting field theory, does it happen? If I have an operator with an anomalous dimension in just any quantum field theory and I multiply?
I'm trying to construct a case in which it does happen.
Okay.
And then you can tell me if it is equal to the cases that you agree with.
Okay. Think about. Anti-locality in field space, what we're talking about.
Yeah, in field space. Okay. Okay, so let me just look at sort of the differentiate sort of way in which this dictionary works. Okay, so ultimately, what Witten said to do is to take this, do a series of integration by parts, and take the finite part of it, and you need to show that that can be reduced to something which looks like phi zero times an operator. And then the quantity that is multiplying you identify as the boundary operator that's sourcing the restriction of that field to the boundary. Okay, so do the integration by parts. This has well-known solutions. They look sort of like this. Okay, and that's the restriction to the boundary. And so if you just evaluate this semi-classically now, and I'll get to this later on, this quantity is the part that you have at the boundary. Okay, and you have to now take the limit that z goes to zero. Okay. So this is the statement. Okay. And PF just means finite part of the integral. Now, there is an equivalent problem which Caffarelli and Silvestri solved. They were looking at a series of, again, elliptic type differential equations. So you have some restriction to the, quote, boundary. And the equation of motion looks like this. And what they showed is that the solution to this, in the limit that z goes to zero, of anything which looks like this, is just the Laplacian raised to this power, a fractional power. Okay, so this equation of motion is very similar to the one that phi obeys. Okay, so what they were trying to do is understand How do you solve differential equations, which are ultimately differential equations involving a fractional power of a derivative? And so you have a differential, let's look at this in terms of z and x. You have fractional powers, you have just sort of real powers, I'm sorry, just integer powers in the full space. But what they found is that as you take this down to the boundary, all of these differential equations involve an anomalous power here, and in fact, they become anti-local operators.
Now, this is, you switched again, haven't you? This is anti-local in the space-time that you're basing the field theory on, right? Or no?
Yes, it is anti-local in the space-time. Okay, so, but so there's a reason why I sort of... Yes, it is anti-local in the space-time. Okay? Because this is not a theory about Hilbert space. It's just differential equations.
Well, how does that relate?
Well, I will get to that. I will get to that. Okay? Okay. Okay, so their point was that the way you make sense of differential equations which look like this is just to extend them to a higher dimension, and all of these differential equations just become ordinary differential equations without this fractional power. Okay? Now, holography is the inverse problem. The reason why it's the inverse problem is that if phi solves the massive scalar equations of motion, say phi is the solution to those equations of motion, g solves the Caffarelli-Silvestri extension theorem. And if g solves the Caffarelli-Silvestri extension theorem, then I know exactly how to go and construct then that boundary operator. I know exactly how to go and take that limit phi partial z phi. It's just this quantity here emerges as the operator which is dual to phi zero. Okay, so by this quantity, this is why...
What's phi zero?
Phi zero is the restriction of the field to the boundary. Okay, so this operator is acting on this... This is acting on... Phi zero is a state in the of the system, so this is acting on a state. So that's why I said ultimately it's a statement about states. Yes.
Normally in ADS-CFT, the operator dual to phi in the bulk is going to be a composite field in the dual field, not a fundamental field with some equation of motion that you get from some action.
It's the CFT. It's
not right. It's CFT, and it's typically, you know, some composite gauge invariant operator.
Okay, that is what is said. And
proposal is. I mean,
that's the proposal.
Yes.
And I'm simply working out exactly what the actual details of how you do the correspondence.
No, but the correspondence is done between a formulation of conformal field theory, which never. Requires this.
What do you mean never requires this? I just went and constructed this operator using what Witten said.
The operator is the Vev of the operator.
Actually, no, this is not the Vev of the operator. Okay, and I'm going to get to that because I'm going to do this in...
CFT is not defined by operators. It's defined by correlation functions.
No, I think you're absolutely... That's not correct. Operators and states in a CFT are completely equivalent. And the Whiteman construction allows you to construct everything to make a statement about the operator by the correlation functions. Now, this approach does not identify the operator with the correlation functions. Okay, that's the Whiteman construction, which I will get to in a few minutes.
I'm sorry, I just want to understand, is when you set this up, there's a lot of things that went by kind of fast. This is where you study the problem in Euclidean ADS? Or this is a relation which is true in some generic Lorentz signature bulk space-time.
This is just Euclidean ADS.
Euclidean ADS.
Yeah.
By the way, if I apply this D'Alembertian gamma to a one over x minus y squared, I get one over x minus y to the right dimension. Is that why you're just translating anomalous dimensions back to free field values?
Okay, I want to show that this also is the case if the theory is interacting. Okay, it will not change, but right. Yes?
I'm trying to understand the relation of this to what's called usually the extrapolate dictionary, where we get O is the limit as you go to the boundary of phi,
yes.
Rescaled by
yes. Yes.
From the boundary to this power. So is that, it almost looks like it's, well, yeah, what's the relation?
Yeah, so right, this would be the extrapolate dictionary.
This is the extrapolate dictionary. Except you have an operator there.
Right. So gamma is the square root of one, d squared plus m squared, right, over four.
But why is delta coming into, why is an operator coming into it?
Because...
Right, isn't this a reformulation of what's usually called the boundary-to-boundary propagator? Or some version
no,
of
no, 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 this is the...
No, but phi naught was the boundary, was something like, was what was described as the boundary value of the Bullock field.
Phi zero, so in the extrapolate dictionary, the CFT is phi zero times O. Mm-hmm. O is this, and that's now, and so what David says, well, you can interpret this as phi zero with this thing sandwiched between the O's, because two derivatives of this is going to give you the correct correlation function of O. Okay. Okay.
That's what I just said.
Okay. So, right. But that was never said, but I'm just saying that if you just go and take this seriously, that's what you end up with.
And so the statement is you calculate it, it's exactly this minus delta to the gamma.
Yeah.
In this context.
Yes. Yes. That's right. Okay. Now, let's go and do this in the BDHM formalism. Okay, so here, one takes these derivatives with respect to the non-renormalizable part of the solution, and you end up with a bulk expectation value of these fields, of n of these fields, with this as a sort of, that gets the dimensions right. Okay, because you know that this thing is scaling like this at the boundary. Okay, now what I want to do is just interpret this within this procedure that Joe developed. So we understand how to go to the UV to the IR by viewing this as the renormalization direction. And I want to break up my action into two pieces, one that involves the fields here and the fields here. Okay, so my action then is just a product of an IR part and a UV part. Okay, now an endpoint function, I will have to take n derivatives with respect to phi, beta rather, and that will involve n insertions of phi tilde. Okay, so I take this quantity right here, I go and do this, and this allows me then to make a correspondence. It allows me to make a correspondence that in fact this functional derivative is actually defining an operator, which in fact is equal to this thing. So we can think about this operator without a VEV as a limit of a particular distribution that you had in the bulk of the system.
And just to be clear, that is the extrapolate.
This is, right. But what I'm saying is that the way the equivalence between the two is that in the Whiteman construction, this procedure actually implies this relationship. Okay. Now, so what I want to do is somehow, right, I have this slide twice. Okay, now, this relationship right here tells me how I construct this operator. Okay, now, if I just go and use the conjugate momentum, I just have this quantity right here. So since I know the asymptotic form, I can trade powers of z for derivatives, and this is what I have right here.
Up to a factor of delta or some such thing.
Yeah, right. But that's not important, okay? It's this functional form. Well, this is exactly the functional form, this is exactly what I need to go and apply the Caffarelli-Silvestri extension theorem. So in two lines, I have the operator that I need. Okay? So, I mean, if this is the quantity that we have in our heads as the operator, then this has to be the form that is consistent with that.
I'm sorry, I missed all this together. I thought we were talking about fields, that this is still linear fields in the bulk, or things that might be interacting?
Let me come to that right now. These are the linear fields in the bulk. Okay. Okay.
But you said for this extension theorem. I don't understand. Because f is not an operator. I mean, if f is the boundary value.
Look. I think what we need to do is this. This is an operator in the CFT, but in the CFT, states and operators are equivalent. Okay. Now states are just operator value distributions.
Yeah.
Okay. So. This is telling you how to calculate the operator state distribution, operator state value distribution of these classical fields, which are just states.
Well, something funny happened here because you're working in Euclidean ADS.
No. You can do this in any signature you want. You'll get the same answer. This is really a function of the fact that. Right.
You can't. I mean, well, maybe you. I don't know what the definitions are, but you know, in Lorentz signature, if you specify what you're calling the boundary values of the field, the bulk is not determined. You need additional retarded or advanced boundary conditions. There's not a unique solution to this.
Okay. Now, if you're saying so, what you're saying is that, right? It does specify that I know what the vacuum is.
Yeah.
Okay. It absolutely does.
You're working in the vacuum.
Okay, right. It does.
So doesn't that mean what you're computing is the vacuum expectation value of the operator and not the operator itself?
No, I think this non-locality, I claim, will persist regardless of what you mean by the vacuum.
But I don't know what you mean by the non-locality or not in the vacuum. In the vacuum, I understand what you're doing.
No,
I don't understand what the context is.
You want to say something before I respond?
Well, the operator you're calculating is on the boundary.
Right.
Now. Okay, so I'm not sure why your comment about solving the bulk is pertinent.
Because that's what's been done to come up with this answer. And the claim is that you can express the...
Look, is your question this statement here?
No.
Because, if you believe that statement, then there's no ambiguity.
I didn't understand what's the use of this... Caffarelli-Silvestri extension.
Because that allows me to go and perform this extrapolation, the z going to zero limit. That's what they went and derived an expression for.
So in Lorentz signature, I do not believe the quantities on the top are determined in terms of what you're calling the boundary values of the fields. I believe that you also need some kind of retarded or advanced boundary conditions or knowledge of working in the vacuum state or something like that. So I'm just confused about what you're trying to say. I'm not saying that it's wrong. I just don't understand what the statement is. If we stick to the vacuum expectation of the operators, I understand the statement, I agree with it. It's the statement effectively that a two-point function is an anti-local operator, which it is, probably by general...
But I'm not saying that I'm not interpreting the two-point function as an operator. I'm saying that in a theory in which, in the Whiteway construction, if you specify all the correlation functions, then you know exactly what the operator is. Okay? Now, at the level of a non-interacting theory, the theory closes at the level of the two-point function, which means I know exactly what the operator is.
But what's f?
You know exactly what the operator is. You're just saying that if the operator is 1 over x minus 1 of fractional power, I can write that as a fractional derivative. I can get rid of the fractional power and write that as in terms of some free field, right?
I can write that as, in terms of the extension theorem, I can write exactly as that fractional Laplacian acting on phi 0.
Something whose you're taking out the anomalous dimension, leaving the delta function.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm happy with that, but I think it's a statement about the vacuum two-point function.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't understand what
it's just, you're making statements about the two-point function.
Well, I'm making a statement about... Yeah, so in other words, I'm ultimately making...
I encounter 1 over x to the gamma. That's a strange propagator.
Right.
It doesn't look local.
Right. It's not a local propagator.
However, I can apply to that, the derivative of some power, some fractional power by some convention, which reduces that to 1 over x squared or whatever.
Right.
So the Laplacian is now a delta function localized.
Right. Right. Okay.
Oh, I see. You want to view this as a transform I want to do on the thing, as opposed to thinking that f is the boundary value of the original field.
Free theory in the bulk translates to some weird theory that is
Yeah, right. Okay.
And now I'll just remove it, make it local in the sense that the right-hand side of the heat space is open. I mean, if you want over X to sub gamma, you apply Laplace. You get something more. If you define a new operator with some fractional power, you can.
Okay, I'm still not sure exactly what's been said outside the vacuum state, but I agree with all these statements.
Okay, so this is actually independent of the interaction. So if you look at just the UV part, it in this renormalization scheme of Joe's, it looks the bulk it looks like this, and the bulk action can possibly have an interaction. Okay, now what I want to do is I want to scale everything by L. Okay, so Z is now Y over L, and I introduce this scaling. This will introduce an L squared here, but I'm taking the limit L goes to zero, keeping this quantity fixed, which means this will be eliminated. My equations of motion, order by order in V, will be in just the same. Sorry, before I do that, there's a 1 over L to the D in front of the action. And because there's a 1 over L to the D in the action, it justifies doing a saddle point approximation to evaluate this action, or to evaluate all of these functional derivatives. And as a result, I can still use the semi-classical approximation, and I can, okay, and then I will see that asymptotically, the solutions look exactly the same. F will be phi 0, and G will be this quantity to the gamma. So this is a statement that even in the interacting theory, the leading order still looks like the fractional Laplacian. Okay? So that's my statement.
Leading order in what?
In the interaction. There will be corrections here, but the leading order is that the theory on the boundary will look like Okay, so now, if you try to maintain a conformality on the boundary, you know, this is not a conformal operator if space-time is curved. You can easily go and correct for all of this. You have to use the Panaeus operator. And this now depends on the scalar curvature. And so just depends on the Ricci curvature here. So the statement then is that at least for a scalar field propagating in the bulk, the analogous theory on the boundary is an antilocal QFT. Okay. How much time do I have?
Negative 25 minutes?
Okay, so let me skip the entropy part or the geodesic completeness part. And just
I have to ask that there's no tension between the theory being anti-local in this sense and local in the standard sense. It can be both, right?
Well, I don't really know what local in the standard. Okay, so I'm not local. I'm not using local in any sense of causality. I'm
exactly.
saying.
There's
okay, no. I'm not using it like that. It's in terms of the operator right. content.
Is the O M Wilson Fisher scalar field at the critical point anti-local?
Okay. Well, I don't know how to think about that.
But you know the correlation function.
Right. So I would go and use my Caffarelli-Silvestri extension theorem.
And you're going to get
Yeah. That's right.
So it's fine. Great.
Yeah.
What theories are, by this definition, not anti-local conformal field theories?
Well,
integer delta.
Free filter.
Things with only right. integer only integer dimensions.
Integer delta, right, but interacting. So I'm just wondering if he has any example.
Could be some.
Not Gaussian, not as a delta.
There might be a conformal field in two dimensions with those properties.
Free field with integer dimensions? You know what I mean?
Well,
yeah, there might be.
The thing is, there's all these kind of Wessemino-Witten models that have free field constructions that are technically interacting. Do you count those? Like the EA. The point is that many of these things right, if the dimensions are integer many times, they end up looking trivial.
What about a free field where you gauge the phi goes to minus phi symmetry? Just kill off half the operators.
Okay, let me just you can talk amongst yourselves. Okay, so I'm just going to not mention the entanglement part and just go back to the original problem. What about the strange metal? Okay, so that was what I was really talking about. This analysis applies to any, if I had a something like this, which looks in the bulk, remember the original dilaton constructions gave a mass to all of the components of the gauge field, so you're really condensing something in all dimensions. But what if you just have a mass along the ADS direction? Okay, if you do that, then your boundary action will look like this. Okay, that's now the Laplacian, David, so it's gauge, so it's rotation, it's rotationally invariant, okay? But gamma will now be this thing, okay? Just by using that same construction, the Caffarelli-Silvestri extension theorem. Okay, which means now that the scaling dimension of this, if you multiply E or not, will not be the standard thing. It will have an anomalous dimension, and you can tune it to be anything you want it to be, just by changing what the mass is.
It's also not a
gauge field. Okay, I'm not going to... Okay, so this is like a dynamical Higgs mode. It gives you an additional length because you have this additional mass here in the theory. Okay, now what are the physical consequences? Okay, these theories will all be invariant under this kind of transformation. Okay, now, if this is true, you no longer have Stokes' theorem in the standard way. Okay, if you don't have it, this means the Arona bone flux has to change. Okay, because going from, so that you can actually construct that by going and defining a local sort of a theory that has an effective gauge transformation which looks like the standard one. And you can go and compute what the Aronoff bone phase should be. You have to integrate this quantity, but this has a connection with the fractional gauge field. And you can do this for any number of geometries. And the point of it is you don't end up with a standard result. You don't end up with pi b r squared. You have something which depends now on the outer radius of the sample and alpha because your theory is now non-local. So whatever is carrying the current is no longer